Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Bernie Sanders won in New Hampshire last night. According to exit polls from CNN, Sanders won more voters under 30 than the rest of the field combined. Pete Buttigieg came in second, Amy Klobuchar came in third, Elizabeth Warren came in fourth, and Joe Biden came in fifth. Starting off today, we're going to talk about the results. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think so far? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Joining us to talk about the results and what's next is Chris Farone, the editor of Dig Boston, an alt weekly. He's also editorial director of the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. Over the past week, Chris has led a team of independent reporters and created a pop-up newsroom in Manchester, New Hampshire, to cover stories collaboratively with New Hampshire media. They went beyond the usual horse race coverage to focus on issues like where candidates stand on nuclear power plants, what their plans say about gig work, and what it's like to cover candidates as a reporter with a disability. And Chris Farone joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. This is great.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we talk about the results last night, I think it's important to point out and remember that the Democratic Party electorate is 40% non-white. But the first two states to vote, the Iowa caucus, New Hampshire last night, are 92% white. New Hampshire is the fourth whitest state in the United States. Iowa is the sixth whitest state. I mean, we talked about this last week, but a lot of people say this system is so outdated and we shouldn't start with these two states. Do you have any thoughts on that to start off with?
I mean, I do not disagree. There's no doubt about it. You know, of course, I waited till I was back in Massachusetts to say that. The people of New Hampshire are very gung-ho, and you know, many of them are well-meaning, but I don't think it's really, I don't really think what you said is deniable. You know, we have, it's not representative in that way. On the other hand, I actually don't believe that this is said enough. New Hampshire does have some significant class diversity, and if you look at the returns from last night, you will see that even, you know, among Democrats, wealthier towns. We had one reporter who grew up in Londonderry, which is a you know, fairly wealthy suburb of Manchester, and you know, he predicted accurately that Pete Buttigieg would take that. So, you know, we definitely, it is not representative of the country for a number of reasons, race in particular, but there are certainly things that we can look at that tell us how this may play out across the country.
Right. And what we did last week when we talked about the Iowa caucus is we pointed out that there were a lot of first-time caucus goers in the Burmese community, for example. Huge Latino turnout. It might be small, but they did turn out in very big numbers. A lot of people in those communities turned out for the very first time. You don't often hear about that in the national media. What else strikes you about New Hampshire? Obviously, it's a majority white state, but there are people of color in New Hampshire. What strikes you about those voters?
Well, for one, it was, you know, it's, what's really striking is the lack of people of color who you see around on the ground, and that even includes, I have to say, this time, it even includes those who are coming in from out of state to work for campaigns. Hmm. You know, nothing against my own senator Elizabeth Warren, of course, I think a well-meaning person. Not always been a huge fan of hers myself, but honestly, some of her events were unbelievably white. Really, even whiter than I would have expected. And that includes people, you know, coming up from out of state. What we saw at, you know, we saw something a little different at Bernie Sanders rallies. We really did see a lot of, you know, young energy, and more people of color. And I have to say, got to give a big shout out to Andrew Yang, who, of course, dropped out of the race last night. Mm. But, you know, we've seen, if there's one thing I think I could agree with some people in the mainstream media, we've seen a lot of, you know, posts. I think a CNN wrote, you know, thank you, Andrew Yang, for kind of, you know, adding many dynamics to this race. But one of them is, of course, he himself is a person of color, but also, you know, that the people around him, there really were, you know, not just a good diverse crowd, but people who had never been involved with politics. We met a woman, a Chinese woman from New York City, who had come up. And we did a little thing on her. She was his top YouTuber. She is somebody who had just not been involved with politics at all, was energized by him. And, you know, candidates like that, you know, she's not going to go away from politics. We asked her about that. So people like that, it took more than just, the usual candidates to get them out.
What about young voters? The Intercept's Ryan Graham had a piece about the New Hampshire youth movement, and he reported that they raised about $500,000 and began hiring a dozen field organizers to fan out across college campuses with the goal of organizing young people. The group did endorse Bernie Sanders, but what about youth turnout in New Hampshire?
Young people were there. When we go campaign to campaign and talk about, I think it goes without saying that the Joe Biden campaign did not have a lot of youth muscle, whereas Andrew Yang, Bernie Sanders certainly did. Also, though, I think what's most notable there is we saw a lot of climate justice activism on behalf of young people from a climate justice forum that was held at one of the colleges early in the week that featured, I believe, all of the candidates to really just grassroots activism out. This was something, environmental justice was something that our readers told us they wanted to hear more about when we were up there. And it was not difficult to find people who wanted to talk about those issues and a range of issues within that canopy. But really, that's what I think the force of young people has been to push a lot of these candidates to address, environmental issues. Whereas I just don't think it is something that would have been, especially among Democrats who could kind of all agree that climate change is bad. When we get into the granular details of plans, that's where I think the young people came out and really asked a lot of specific questions.
It was interesting to look at exit polls. According to one exit poll, 6 in 10 New Hampshire Democratic voters said they want Medicare for all. And they also said that the climate crisis is in their top 3 issues. So you've got the health care, the climate crisis, and the economy.
Yeah. And, the economy, of course, when young people especially are polled, or in anyone's polled about the economy, that means something different to all of us, doesn't it? I know there are people who may be especially worried about the auto loan bubble blowing up, but a lot of people worried about their own jobs. Speaking of young people, though, as a lot of our readers told us, they want to hear about the gig economy. Mm. So we had one of our great reporters, Ariella Shapiro. She went out and spoke to candidates as well as campaigns and people who are out working for candidates about, these different plans for the gig economy. And we kind of found that even candidates who we would think might have a good grip on this stuff, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, even they were kind of lacking and really kind of trying to lump in gig workers with being potential union workers as if that is the easiest solution. So, I think for us the lesson was, of course, we've really tried to play it straight. Nevertheless, a lot of our reporters have progressive leanings, and it still is important to question the candidates who you think may agree with you on certain issues. We definitely found that the Sanders and the Warren platforms were lacking when it came to answers about how to really deal with the gig economy. Andrew Yang, his camp was even more so willing to engage us than the others, but he fell short a little bit as well. So, I think that when we're talking about the economy, it means something different to everybody individually, of course, but even when we look at this generationally, when we spoke to young people, we kept hearing the same thing. I'm a gig worker. We spoke to people who are Uber and Lyft drivers, and that is a that is definitely a subtopic that I hope more reporters start talking about.
Yeah,
it's something people want to hear about.
It's such a good point. That is Chris Farone, editor of Dig Boston and Alt Weekly, and editorial director of the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. And he's led a team of independent reporters. They created a pop-up newsroom in Manchester, New Hampshire, to really go beyond the horse race, to focus on things like the gig economy, what it's like to cover candidates as a reporter with a disability. And I hope you can take some time to read their great reports. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. So, Chris, again, Bernie Sanders came in first last night, followed by Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden. We're going to spend more time talking about media coverage of all of this on Friday. But I just wonder, what are you hearing from people? You know, I have to say, I'm so surprised to see what is happening with Elizabeth Warren. Just the fact that she came in fourth. When she came in third in Iowa ahead of Joe Biden, the media pretty much glossed over her. And basically, they wrote so many stories and talked all week about Amy Klobuchar and her rise.
It has been interesting to see how much more the establishment likes Klobuchar. You know, kept hearing about a, you know, she had like a decent performance in the debate. You know, to be expected. She is a prosecutor and an intelligent person. But also, you know, and then she had, you know, some. She did well in the last fundraising round. So all we heard half the time in Manchester was that Klobuchar, you know, some kind of Klobuchar surge. You know, I'm an alt media person. I am often screaming at the Boston Globe, our local mainstream paper in New England. But at the same time, I am also sometimes the person who tells, you know, other, you know, who challenges other progressives and says, you know, this is not as much of a conspiracy as it may appear. I remember when Occupy Wall Street started, everyone saying there was a media blackout, and I put together a list of 50 mainstream news sources that had published a story. But in this case, it's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. You know, for the absolute, you know, Elizabeth Warren is one thing, but the absolute denial that Bernie Sanders is in the lead, is winning, is having the results he have, and. You know, this is, I'll just say, this is why we have a pop-up newsroom. A lot of people from outside, you don't realize it, but when you're in New Hampshire, all of the big media from NBC, ABC, PBS, even our local NPR affiliate, they are all in the same hotel. They rent out the same hotel. They have Radio Row. They're sitting next to each other. Candidates and surrogates go up and down from place to place. And this is where we hear these talking points fester, where they develop. And, you know, this is why you hear crazy things. Chuck Todd said on television last night that, you know, there still could be a big Kennedy endorsement. I mean, it's almost, and that's going to change things. They're really grasping for straws. You know, for me, it was never about the horse race anyway. We went up there to do coverage that's going to last for a while. You know, this is important stuff that people are going to want to know about. These are evergreen stories. But I was absolutely disgusted. And I'm, you know, I often, you know, air out my grievances about these things on Twitter. I certainly was last night, but it's above and beyond horrendous. I've never seen anything like it. But when I was there and I could, you know, hear these people speaking with each other, at one point the bar that we had rented out, NBC had one of their analysts come in and do a little chat at the bar, and it was almost like he was living in a different world. I don't know where he had been going. But a lot of the things they say, they really just don't play out in real life.
What did he
say? We did not find young Pete Buttigieg supporters. They barely exist, for example.
What did he say? I'm just curious.
It was almost like going candidate by candidate beside Sanders and explaining, you know, why they hadn't done well, why they might surge. And then questioning, you know, the base that Sanders does have.
Wow.
And he's the guy in the front now. And I understand if you want to beat him up. That's kind of an analyst job. But I feel like there's an air of dishonesty that is really not doing anyone good. But, of course, these are the people who don't, you know, certainly didn't predict anything correctly in 4 years ago. So I'm not sure why we're listening to them now.
Well, exactly. I mean, we're going to definitely talk more about how they're covering or not covering Bernie on Friday. But Reuters is getting a lot of criticism. They put out a tweet last night saying Pete Buttigieg finishes second in New Hampshire, Amy Klobuchar third. They didn't even mention Bernie.
It's really interesting because I know that any, you know, on its own, any tweet like that could look, you know, when you're holding it up, like, hey, it's a one-off, you're peddling something that's really not true. But, you know, there are websites like Common Dreams that are aggregating, you know, dozens of examples. So I don't think it's some grand conspiracy. I don't think there was a meeting. Certainly I wouldn't have been invited where everybody talked and said, this is what we're going to do. But, you know, there is this general fear. And, you know, for what it is, it's a good thing that there are still a lot of alternative media sources out there to kind of give the other story, you know. And I can't stress enough that, not only are we not in the bag for Bernie, I got in a huge argument as the in the middle of the primaries with his on Twitter And a lot of his supporters understood because they had denied access to one of our reporter who was writing about disabilities, who is disabled, and also to another one of my reporters. So you know, this is, you know, we were up there to cover it, you know, as fairly as possible. But at the same time, we also, you know, we have eyes and ears, and we saw everything else going on. It really was just, it's really a big waste of time. A lot of things coming out of these people, these talkers' mouths. It's just that. It's just talk. That's what they do.
Yeah. Well, that was also a very interesting story about your reporter who talked about what it was like with a disability to try to cover these candidates. Let's take a few calls, Chris. Let's hear from GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter for years now, and primarily because you know, his agenda, what he would do, would be an incredible transformation in this country, not just of politics, but of a lot of things like Medicare for All and things like that. So that's my comment. I have a question, though. I think you discussed it just a bit ago, but I'm really concerned about the activities of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, and in general, sort of the top of the Democratic Party establishment. It seems to me that they have done what they can to suppress Bernie's rise. I don't know if it's suppressed, but you've mentioned the media maybe just let him out, leaving him out sometimes. I believe he could definitely just slaughter Trump, so to speak, in the election. But I'm concerned that a lot of people, at least some people, are suggesting that he can't beat Trump because his agenda is so radical. So I'm interested in both of those things, Democratic suppression and his real chances of beating Trump.
Well, thank you, GS. We briefly touched on this last week, but a number of commentators are saying that the wealthy donors who are Democrats are very frightened of Bernie. In fact, they said, and some of them are more frightened of Bernie becoming the nominee than Trump winning the election. Just quickly, what are your thoughts on this, Chris?
I think they should be, and I think that's fine. And I think that, you know, briefly, I was on the floor in Tampa in, 2014 or 2012 when they you know, brought security guards onto the floor and took of the Republican National Convention and removed Ron Paul's delegates physically. And after that, I said to myself, you know, with Trump, I go, there's no way this party is going to let Donald Trump be the nominee. They wouldn't even let Ron Paul have a couple of delegates. But I was wrong. And the reason I was wrong, and obviously Republicans and Democrats are slightly different in how they operate, although they both are machines. But I was wrong because Trump ended up having this overwhelming, you know, love him or hate him, he had this unbelievable movement behind him and a lot of people who support him, and they couldn't do that. And of course, the we've already seen what the pundits are up to. Certainly, I do not think that everything that went on in Iowa was legitimate from the poll, you know, from the poll being from the Des Moines Register poll being from being held back to what happened with the caucuses. But it's not going to matter at the end if the movement's there, and forget about the big donors, if those individual donations continue to roll in, like I'm sure they are as we have this conversation right now on the heels of victory in New Hampshire for the Sanders campaign. It's just going to be too much momentum by the time it comes to the DNC. If he cleans up across the country, and I've got to say, look at that field. You know, look at how pathetic Joe Biden looks right now, how bad he looks right now. Look at Elizabeth Warren's tone last night. If Sanders keeps on stepping over everyone, if Pete Buttigieg is going to be his biggest competition, by the time he gets to the DNC, those worries, sure, you're still going to have them. But I'll end by saying this. I think that if Bernie Sanders gets elected, that's the day that the real fight begins. Until I think this almost might be easy street.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back in the coming weeks because we'll continue to cover all of this
from a
grassroots perspective. And really, thank you for working with local reporters to focus on actual issues.
No doubt about it.
Thank you. That's Chris Farone, editor of Dig Boston and editorial director of the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. They had a pop-up newsroom in Manchester, New Hampshire, where they focused on things like the gig economy, nuclear power plants, what it's like to cover candidates as a reporter with a disability. And you can find their stories at yourcallradio.org. Well, we always get together and really think long and hard about how we should cover the race. And we feel like there's been so much coverage of who's up and who's down and a very simplistic frame about the left versus the center. And I'm not hearing much about where the candidates stand on actual issues. So we're going to look at their records and their plans on racial justice issues. The Center for Urban and Racial Equity is out with a scorecard where they rate candidates on criminal justice reform, health, reproductive justice, voting rights, indigenous rights, immigration, and more. And joining us to talk about this scorecard is Dr. Judy Lubin, founder and president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity. That's an organization that works to advance equity through policy, systems, institutional, community, and societal change. Dr. Lubin is a sociologist and a racial justice advocate. She's a researcher in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at Howard University and co-founder of Sociologists for Justice, an independent collective of over 2,000 scholars organized in response to the disproportionate killing of Black people by police. Hi, Dr. Lubin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. I'm so glad you put this scorecard together. Why did you decide to look at, it's such a wide range of issues. So I guess the question is, how did you do a scorecard on such a wide range of issues?
Yeah, so we thought it would be critical for this presidential campaign, particularly during the primary season where Democratic voters are choosing potentially the next president of the United States, to really center racial justice in the conversation, because far too often the issues that affect communities of color really don't get enough or sufficient treatment and discussion. And the other part of this is also that oftentimes communities of color feel that candidates don't really take their issues seriously and pander to them during election season. So we put together this scorecard because we wanted to hold candidates accountable for centering racial justice in their campaigns. We wanted to provide voters with a tool for making an informed decision. But as you mentioned, there are a lot of different issues in this scorecard, and we saw this also as an opportunity to articulate a shared agenda and solidarity among Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities that are experiencing racism in many different ways, but also in very similar ways, and where we could highlight opportunities, particularly from a policy perspective. We wanted to do that with this scorecard.
So you looked at their record, and then you also looked at their policy prescriptions.
That's right. So we have 10 categories that we looked at in the scorecard, and each category we assigned a maximum of 10 points, and their record was part of the grading or the scoring. So they could earn up to 100 points within 10 categories that included criminal justice, voting rights, the racial wealth gap in housing, indigenous rights, immigration, environmental justice, health and reproductive rights, as well as educational equity. We also wanted to highlight where they stand on reparations, and the last category looked at their record on race.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll go over these candidates' records. Dr. Judy Lubin is founder and president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, and they are out with a scorecard on candidates on racial justice. Elizabeth Warren got an A-, Bernie Sanders B+, Pete Buttigieg B+, Amy Klobuchar C, Tom Steyer D, Joe Biden D, Michael Bloomberg F, Tulsi Gabbard F, and Donald Trump F. And you can find the scorecard along with you can look at one that's kind of gives you an overview and then one that really goes into detail. And that's at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or you have a question that feels should be answered, you can join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email, yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with veteran journalist Monique Alfasi, co-author of the new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. She offers a detailed account of how Trump uses wealth and power to abuse women and details more than a dozen new allegations against Trump by women who have never spoken out before. She says the system has allowed this behavior to go on for decades. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be continuing our ongoing conversation about how the media are covering the presidential race. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you have any questions about where the candidates stand on issues around racial justice, we'd love to hear from you. The Center for Urban and Racial Equity is out with an extensive scorecard. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dr. Judy Lubin is founder and president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, and they're out with this scorecard. So, Dr. Lubin, we have about, say 30 minutes to really go over this. Why don't we just try to go over as many candidates as we can, and you can offer the highlights. So at the very top of your list is Elizabeth Warren. She got an A-. Why does she stand out among the other candidates with a strong platform?
Well, Elizabeth Warren stands out for many other reasons that she stands out in a number of other different areas is because she's good at making plans. And this scorecard, I will say, heavily emphasizes proposals and plans. And so when you look at Elizabeth Warren proposals in terms of health care, education, and other issues that we looked at in the scorecard, she stood out in terms of really being explicit and intentional about raising racial justice issues and how she would go about addressing racial inequities across various issues.
And just for a few more on Elizabeth Warren, I mean, I love how you put this together because you've got a condensed version and then a lengthy version. Warren's Housing Plan for America will invest $500 billion over 10 years to build, preserve, and rehabilitate low-income rental housing. She talks about redlining on a regular basis, and then with an explicit focus on reducing the black-white racial wealth gap, her plan includes a first-time home buyer down payment assistance program for low-income people who've lived in formerly redlined or segregated neighborhoods for at least 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so really unique and trying to figure out ways to target resources, particularly to black communities that have experienced systemic racism in housing, and we know that housing and ability to afford a home and grow equity is, for the most part, the ways in which the average person is able to build wealth in this country. And we there's been a lot of discussion over the past few years about the racial wealth gap and redlining. And so in her policy, she really tries to figure out a way to direct the resources so that you begin to address some of the systemic inequities in housing and the racial wealth gap. And so we thought that was really, really unique policy and has great potential in terms of addressing. And really the racial wealth gap is actually growing.
Right.
And so this is really important for those who care about racial justice issues and economic justice issues that we are developing intentional policies that really get at some of the root causes of these disparities.
Another thing that would get to the root cause of some of these disparities is proposing $50 billion in aid to historically black colleges and universities. She also wants to increase teacher pay and work with HBCUs and the Bureau of Indian Education grantees to increase teacher diversity. That's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, critically important. And so these were a number of issues that we looked at across candidates, the teacher diversity question. We wanted to understand, or we wanted to see that the candidates were addressing teacher diversity, that they were devoting some funding and had a plan around how to engage HBCUs, as well as how to support students of color from the, at the K-12 level as well.
I appreciate that you also say in here about Elizabeth Warren, despite the controversy surrounding her claims of Cherokee ancestry, Warren has proposed the Honoring Promises to Native Nations Act. A lot of Natives were very angry, distressed about what she said about Cherokee ancestry, because it does have long-lasting ramifications. I mean, I've seen so many memes about Pocahontas, and it's just, you know, things like this are thrown out on a regular basis. And I feel like that's gotten lost. So you talked about this under Elizabeth Warren, and then talked about how she wants to address underfunding and barriers to sovereignty in Indigenous communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one thing I'll say is that almost none of these candidates don't have any issues in terms of racial, in terms of race and in their background. And so, and I would say that largely Elizabeth Warren is going into, is largely because of some of the questions about her claims of Native American ancestry. So she was deemed in the record and rhetoric category of the scorecard. And we thought it was really important that we recognized the history there. And, you know, we get emails and Twitter messages that from folks that say, how can you give Elizabeth Warren an A-minus given her history with Native, claiming Native American ancestry. And so, you know, that's why that category is there, that record and rhetoric category is there to assess the candidates on their backgrounds and not just the policies that they're proposing during the election and wanting to be in solidarity as a Black woman, wanting to be in solidarity with Native American communities. We had to uplift the problematic claims around Native American ancestry, and she has tried, she's apologized and has tried to rectify that through various policies and also consultative efforts with Native tribes in developing those policies.
So Elizabeth Warren gets your top mark, an A+. Dr. Lubin, are you surprised at where Elizabeth Warren is coming in and the races so far in Iowa? She came in third before Joe Biden, but the media barely talked about her. And then last night, she came in fourth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. I was listening to the conversation before I joined. Yeah, it's really interesting to see the dynamics that are shaping the election where, I mean, there's a challenge, if you will, going on between the centrist and the more progressive wings of the party, and everyone is afraid that if they don't choose the right candidate, Donald Trump will be reelected again. And I say, choose the candidate that you believe in. Choose the candidate that represents your values. And when we get to the general election, we fight like heck to make sure that candidate gets into office.
Well, you can find the scorecard, the racial justice scorecard, at yourcallradio.org. Let's now talk about Bernie Sanders. He got a B+. And as you report in this scorecard, he is the only candidate calling for all people with felony convictions to be allowed to vote while in prison. He's been a leader in pushing for a $15 minimum wage. He said he wants to remove the profit motive from the criminal justice reentry system, and he wants to move the U.S. away from a relationship of paternalism and control of Indigenous communities towards one of deference and support. What else stands out for you when it comes to Bernie Sanders' racial justice record and platform?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say Bernie Sanders has come a long way. and like all of the candidates, are still a work in progress. But if we go back to 2016, when he was campaigning, you know, Bernie, you know, often talks about economic inequality, and that's the basis of his analysis, and have historically struggled with talking about race and recognizing that racism is a separate determinant of outcomes in this country outside of class and economic indicators. But Bernie Sanders was challenged during his last run for the presidency by Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter's advocates, and I think since from then has really worked on his analysis and understanding of race. I still see in some of his interviews the struggle sometimes with mm-hmm. with recognizing that yes, this is a separate system that is operating with class and with economic inequality. But you know, you definitely hear him now talking about systemic and structural racism, and you see some of that reflected in his policies. We don't see it to the extent that we see it in Elizabeth Warren's policy platform. And so one of the areas where we don't see it is, although on his website he recognizes there's a racial wealth gap and says, you know, he will fight to address the racial wealth gap, we don't see an actual plan to actually distribute resources or strategy on how he would address the racial wealth gap.
You point out that Sanders also co-sponsored the Protect Access to Birth Control Act, which aims to repeal Trump's birth control rules. Sanders has also put forth the Thurgood Marshall Plan for Public Education, which seeks to combat racial discrimination and school segregation and provide equitable funding for public schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really important issues. You know, as we think about racial justice, it's not just one category, and that's what we mean when we say systemic racism, right? It's operating across pretty much every aspect of our lives, and so we want to hear and see from the candidates that they were thinking through a systemic lens, right, and not just thinking about policy through one narrow lens in terms of how you address racial inequity, that it has to be across the board and really every policy area.
Pete Buttigieg also got a B+. Dr. Lubin, this morning on Democracy Now!, Henry Davis Jr., a South Bend city council member who worked with Pete Buttigieg, said that under his tenure, Black residents in South Bend were 4.3 times more likely to be arrested for possessing marijuana than white people. He also said that, you know, he basically condemned Buttigieg's treatment of the Black community in South Bend during his time as mayor, calling out systemic racism in the police force, for example. And I saw on your Facebook page that a number of people responded to the B+ rating for Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, so this is probably, Buttigieg is probably one of the candidates that we hear a lot from in terms of how did he get a B+.
Right.
and it's the structure of this school power, which weighs heavily on policy proposals. This is one of the learnings that we've gained from this scorecard, in that in the future we would put more emphasis on the record. So the record category would potentially be worth 15 to 20 points versus 10 points and being, you know, the same amount of points across each of the other categories that we looked at in the scorecard. So Buttigieg has put out a Douglas plan that, again, is really thinking or is applying a systemic racial equity lens, looking across a number of different areas. And so that's largely why you see the B+ grade there, because all of the categories from educational equity to environmental justice, for example, in the environmental justice category, we were looking to see that candidates were developing or identifying, one, the importance of elevating the issue of environmental justice within the White House, recognizing the need for impact assessments, particularly when there are major developments or infrastructure projects that really look at, that apply a racial equity lens and impact that would have on communities of color. And we saw that in Buttigieg's plan. We were looking for an articulation of the seriousness of lead and having a plan to address the harmful impact of lead, you know, through upgrading our water systems and infrastructure. And you know, he checked the box in a number of different areas as well, criminal justice. And most of the candidates, interestingly, there are a few, but Both of the candidates are where we want them to be, especially the leading ones on criminal justice reform.
And you point out that Buttigieg's Douglas plan states he will prioritize funding for programs aimed at pretrial reforms, decarceration, and an expansion of alternative to incarceration programs. So that's Pete Buttigieg. He got a B+. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Judy Lubin, founder and president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, and they are out with a scorecard rating a wide range of racial justice issues like reproductive justice, voting rights, indigenous rights, immigration, and more. And you can find the scorecard at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Dr. Lubin, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about Amy Klobuchar now. You gave her a C grade. According to the report card, Klobuchar's policing platform, unfortunately, is in line with the 1994 crime bill. As a prosecutor, she did not press charges in more than two dozen cases where people were killed by police. And her office regularly went after low-level offenses like vandalism and pushed for long prison sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so criminal justice, again, continues to be a major concern for black and brown communities, thanks to movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, right? The issues of just the myriad of issues, you know, have come to the fore and the forefront of people's understanding of how race operates in this country, and that the criminal justice system is the primary, is one of the primary ways in which we reinforce racial inequity in this country. And so we've got to address this issue head on. And so in the criminal justice category, one of the areas that we assessed for was police reform. We want to see the candidates talking about police reform and being clear that policing is a crisis, is not working in this country, particularly in the ways in which policing is practiced in communities of color. And so when we latest update, we still haven't seen a police reform strategy articulated by Senator Klobuchar. She's said she supported ending cash bail. We'd love to see more stronger articulation on some of these issues. And so that's where she's being hit in that category on criminal justice. There are supposed to be a couple of other areas where we're not. The record, and you read some of the issues with her record. And so that's another area where her score was affected.
And we just
haven't seen as much of a race explicit analysis across her various policies. And so that was also really critical for us as we're looking at policies, and also as we're listening to the candidates during the debate and at public events. Are they really are they really using a systemic analysis and not being afraid to talk about racial inequity and racial injustice?
And because Klobuchar is moving up, there seems to be more coverage about her record on these issues. The AP just had a piece called Amy Klobuchar Helped Jail Teen for Life, but Case Was Flawed. And they're writing about Mayon Burrell. An AP investigation into the 17-year-old case uncovered new evidence and inconsistencies, raising questions about whether he was railroaded by police. And the lead is, it was a prime time for Amy Klobuchar. And, you know, saying that she's tough on crime. If you'd like to read this article, it's actually getting more attention. She's actually being asked about it now, and we'll put it up at yourcallradio.org. So that's Amy Klobuchar. She got a C. Tom Steyer got a D. Tell us a little bit about Tom Steyer.
So Tom Steyer is interesting. Tom Steyer doesn't have much of a record that we could identify in terms of racial justice issues, and so he was dinged a bit there in that category. And just when we looked across the board on his policies, we didn't see that racially explicit attention to various issues affecting black and brown communities. And so that's where he hit with the D. He has, I think he calls it the five rights program or plan where he talks about the importance of universal health care and a number of different issues. He does highlight, you know, racial inequity, but again, we're not seeing a level of detail, and we're not seeing positions on key areas that we looked at in the scorecard for Steyer.
Joe Biden also got a D, and according to his report card, he has not offered a detailed immigration plan. His website does not mention ICE. He hasn't taken a firm stand on reforming or abolishing the agency. He seemed confused by the idea of decriminalization of immigration during the September debate. He hasn't released a policy plan for indigenous communities. And the scorecard says many of Biden's health care plans do not go far enough in addressing the needs of communities of color.
Well, you summarized it well. So Biden also was hit in the record category as well. Or took a ding in the record category because of his championing of crime bills in the 1980s and 1990s that helped to fuel the mass incarceration movement and war on drugs. We've also saw for a while he somewhat waffled on where he stands on reparations. And so we were giving, I think, there were 7 points to all of the candidates just for clearly articulating a bare minimum support for the bills that are in Congress right now to study reparations. And so those bills don't actually say reparations will be issued, but it's just to study it. And so we still haven't been able to get a clear idea where Joe Biden stands on reparations. And so specific being there in that category as well, but you know, in some areas like healthcare and a few other areas, we see Biden taking a more centrist and conservative perspective that just doesn't move the systems in the way that we need them to move to address, you know, racial inequity.
So that's Joe Biden. Joe Biden got a D in the racial justice scorecard from the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, and Michael Bloomberg got an F. And according to the scorecard, he's getting a lot of attention, especially yesterday and today, about stop and frisk. And I'll read the quote that he was recorded in 2015 and some audio was just leaked. But before we do that, according to the scorecard, during his tenure, stop and frisk police stops exploded, with police making over 5 million stops of mostly Black and Latinx men and boys during Bloomberg's 3 terms as mayor. What really stood out for you when you looked at his record on that?
Everything that you read. So stop and frisk was a horrific racist policy that targeted Black and brown men in New York City. And what really stood out to me was that it wasn't that Bloomberg wasn't aware of how harmful the policy was. He continued to defend it, even when residents of his city, civil rights and civil liberties organizations pointed out and pleaded with him to put an end to the practice. And he doubled down in justifying it, and folks can Google and see some of the language and the stereotypes that he evoked in trying to explain and justify a policy that did not work. It did not reduce crime. And so that is really concerning for me, especially when we're in a conversation about policy. We want to know what, you know, candidates will do. And so when he was in a position to put an end to a policy that clearly had harmful, traumatic outcomes for Black and brown people, he chose not to. And so you know, this is probably one of those where it's as Charles Blow from the New York Times says, this is non-negotiable.
Mm. Well, the audio that was uncovered from 2015 and is now out, Bloomberg said, quote, "You've got to get the guns out of the hands of the people that are being killed. You want to spend the money on a lot of cops in the streets, put the cops where the crime is, which means in minority neighborhoods. And the way you get the guns out of kids' hands is to throw them up against the walls and frisk them," end quote. So Bloomberg just recently issued a statement via Twitter saying, quote, "I have apologized for taking too long to understand the impact of stop and frisk on Black and Latino communities. I inherited stop and frisk. In an effort to stop gun violence, it was overused. I cut back by 95%, end quote. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the fact that he would bring up the apology, right, says that the apology to me was not sincere. So part of a sincere apology is to not only recognize the harm, but be clear about how you're going to address or try to rectify in the ways that you can rectify the harm. So interestingly for us is that he's apologized and he's launched his campaign, and we don't see a policing reform agenda articulated. So if he really is sorry and believes that there's a problem with policing communities of color, that should be the first thing, one of the first things that you come out with is a policy for how you're going to address this from your presidency. So, for example, under the Trump administration, we've seen a tailing back of investigations of police departments, of the practices, policing practices, investigations that were used to at least try to hold police departments accountable for racial inequities that were happening under their police forces. And so that's one thing that Bloomberg could have said right away, out the box, if he really was serious about what he said. And it's going to take more than one apology, right? Like, it's not enough. It's really going to take being in community, speaking with Black people, speaking with Latinx communities, and being sincere and wanting to learn, and really wanting to learn about what the impact of stop and frisk type of policies really have on people. And so when you listen to the ways in which he described the policy, even just a few years ago. And so that's the other question, right? This was just a few years ago, several years after he was out of office, as late as 2015, right, still describing the policy and justifying it and describing Black and brown men in ways that are really dehumanizing. And so for me and for us at the center, you know, Bloomberg still has a long way to go on understanding how the criminal justice system is used to really harm communities of color.
And Michael Bloomberg, again, he got an F in the racial justice scorecard. Tulsi Gabbard also got an F, and Donald Trump got an F. And you can find more information about the scorecard at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Judy Lubin is founder and president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity. They work to advance equity through community and societal change. Dr. Lubin, thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This was wonderful.
Well, thank you for putting this together. And you can find the scorecard at yourcallradio.org. We are really thinking about how we are going to cover this race. We also wanted to do a show about environmental scorecards. If you have any other ideas for us, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.